This is Fanboy versus Transformers with Chris.
This week on Fanboy versus Transformers, we're pleased to present an interview with James Roberts, writer of More Than Meets the Eye. Mr. Roberts was kind enough to sit down with me on the evening of March 26th to discuss the recently concluded Elegant Chaos story, among other topics. This interview does contain some spoilers. If that's a concern for you, be sure you're caught up through issue 38 of More Than Meets the Eye before you listen. So, first of all, James, thank you very much for taking the time to sit down and talk with me today.
You are more than welcome.
So I'd like to start by talking about the Elegant Chaos story that just wrapped up.
Mm-hmm.
Was this piece of the overall More Than Meets the Eye story always about Brainstorm trying specifically to target Megatron through his history, or was there a point when there were other possible targets that would have allowed reaching a similar end?
I think because it gets a bit hazy. I think it's always going to be a sort of let's kill Hitler story. Brainstorm. It was always a time machine in the briefcase. Brainstorm was always going to be. Brainstorm was the most likely candidate to be actually traveling in time. At one stage, it could possibly have been Rewind or Chrome Dome and Rewind on a sort of Dominus Ambus related mission. That was the alternative. But whenever Brainstorm was in the mix as the principal time traveler, it was going to be let's go back and stop the Decepticons. But a lot of the layers of detail and motivation and all that stuff didn't come around until season two, when obviously Megatron was on board. It was back in issue 16 where Brainstorm talks about having had a Kundrunx Endura, or he alludes to that fact, and even when I wrote that, it was sort of a background detail that could become useful rather than me thinking, okay, this is going to be his motivation for traveling back in time, whatever. Things were moved a little bit into alignment as we went along, beyond the means of traveling back in time. Nothing was really nailed down.
So presumably when you planned this, Megatron wasn't expected to be with the crew in the present day. So what did you think when it turned out you'd be able to actually have Megatron involved firsthand?
That may have tipped it definitively into it becoming a sort of let's kill Megatron type storyline. Megatron being Megatron, if you are going to do one of those classic sort of kill them at birth type things, it was always going to be him. But having him on board as a crew member gave it a nice twist and an extra layer of drama or melodrama or whatever, kept things interesting. So that was good, actually. And that's true of a lot of season two or older season two plots, by which I mean stuff that I'd sort of had sketched out to do, between issues 25 and 50 or whatever. A lot of that has perhaps surprisingly still been usable, and in some cases has become more interesting with Megatron in the mix. So I think that's mainly down to luck, but great, I'll take it.
Sometimes luck is the writer's best friend, from what I've heard.
Absolutely, yeah, it could all go wrong. I mean, season two is all mapped out, and I know where it's going. But the anxiety was around the decision back, I think, round about when Shadowplay was being written, the decision round about then to bring Megatron along for season two. And so I remember going back, this was after a meeting at Hasbro, and back in the hotel room that night, just sort of thinking, okay, what does it actually mean for the various longer term plot threads? Like I say, it's turned out okay, and perhaps if anything, it's taught me not to be too not to nail things down too much for and too far ahead, really. So season three is a little bit loose at the moment, because who knows what will happen.
So based on the meeting with Hasbro, you knew as far back as around Shadowplay that you'd be able to bring Megatron in as a character down the line?
Yes, and I think actually to clarify, I think it was when Shadowplay it was when Shadowplay came out. So it's probably around about the publication of issue 9 or 10, late 2012. So yeah, so it was around about then. I mean, so I suppose I was writing issue 14 or something at the time. So it was still a good, you know, couple of years. Yeah, it's a good year and a half away from issue 28 and post Dark Cybertron and stuff. So
was there ever any point along like that the lag time between those events where you were just kind of like salivating at the prospect of, can I introduce him yet? Can I introduce him yet and start working on this plot line?
On the Megatron thing?
Yeah.
Yeah. Probably, I think, you know, by that point, having, yeah, as I say, writing issue 14, and with Dark Cybertron suddenly scheduled for around about 2020, it became 21, it ultimately became 23. There was, you know, it was all about, you know, wrapping up season one. There wasn't any real scope. I do like to plant little seeds, as you know, and to have little foreshadowing here and there, but there wasn't much room to do that with Megatron. In fact, I mean, yeah, even, I mean, this by this point, I mean, John had already written written the return of Megatron in Robots in Disguise, and the, you know, the circumstances of his return, his actions upon his return, that was definitely sort of old school pre-Dark Cybertron Megatron, if you like. That was the Megatron that was going to continue to be, you know, a bad guy. And it was, you know, I think too late to it was impossible to unpick too much of that. So really our first opportunity to properly prepare the way for the big switch was Dark Cybertron itself. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So getting back toward Elegant Chaos, at one point I believe I read where you had mentioned Brainstorm's briefcase was like a safety net for the stories in case you needed to wrap things up kind of early if the book didn't go as long as you had hoped. Elegant Chaos kind of shows a lot of signs of that when you look back through it. So how much of that plan, like backdoor, actually ended up being part of that storyline?
Good question, because I do vaguely remember saying that, but I don't know whether that's, yeah, whether I think my point was more that mysteries such as the briefcase thing, you know, that there's various ways in which I can bring that, you know, bring them to a rapid conclusion. I don't think it was necessary. If I said it, I was either lying or getting confused, because it wasn't the briefcase itself wasn't the means by which to wrap things up quickly. With the Brainstorm arc and Dark Cybertron, there was another thing. I mean, there was the fact that he was more dead than alive, which is something that we weaved into Dark Cybertron, when originally that was definitely a season two plot unrelated to any of the Dark Cybertron stuff, because we didn't know that was going to happen. It was very much a self-contained within More Than Meets the Eye story. And I've saved some of that to use in season three. So I'm not going to talk about it too much, but yeah, certainly the Brainstorm briefcase, Brainstorm's half dead spark, his motivations for traveling in time, they've bounced around a bit, sort of as a result of bigger events. But generally speaking, and it's still the case actually, if John or Hasbro or whoever said, you know, you've got 6 issues to wrap this up, yeah, there's some mysteries that would remain unresolved, but they wouldn't be ones which, yeah, people wouldn't notice them too much by their absence. A bit like at the end of Elegant Chaos, when we sort of reveal the Lost Light and the Spark Eater are both sort of part of a time loop. Had I never said that, had that never been established, it wouldn't have detracted too much from the experience of, you know, of the overall More Than Meets the Eye series. I think it's a nice detail to have, and I think I find it satisfying. I think it's a good thing, but, you know, people wouldn't have, you know, looked back on More Than Meets the Eye and said, you know what, you know, we never really found out, you know, where that Spark Eater, how it ended up on board. You know, it wasn't a big mystery. So if given 6 issues, ideally 8, then I could sort of bring things to a rapid conclusion. But much in the same way that Babylon 5, which is a series that I didn't really watch, but I was, and this is sadly typical of me, I was much more aware of the structure and the behind the scenes things and the way that you know, it was written. That when they thought series 4 was going to be their last, or season 4, sorry, for our American listeners, was going to be the last season. And so pretty much they stripped away all the inessential non-arc or non-myth arc stories and just focused relentlessly on the important stuff. They pretty much, as I understand it, you know, told the whole story by the end of season four. Of course, then they were given an extra season, a bit like Community. So yeah, I could jettison all the sort of, if you like, nice to have stuff, and focus mercilessly on the huge plot things. And I reckon I could get through it. It wouldn't be ideal, but importantly, it wouldn't leave people hanging on stuff. So.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's, I mean, you know, in the terrible circumstance that they would tell you, yeah, I mean, wrap this up early. It's good to know that you've kind of got at least an outline in your head of how you could get the most bang out of the time they would give you still.
Yeah, yeah, because my fear has always been, you know, shortchanging people by, you know, or lost syndrome, where those are the two ways in which things can unravel, really, or can piss people off. One is that, you know, you haven't got a game plan at all. You know, you're sort of making it up as you go along, because people will sniff that out and tear you apart, quite rightly. So I'm covered on that side of things. And the other one, as we've just been speaking about, is the sudden rug pull, when actually you don't get a chance to wrap things up, and it's clearly not a satisfying way to stop. Unless you do a really enigmatic thing like the end of The Prisoner or something, or the end of Quantum Leap. But no, I don't think the storyline wouldn't really lend itself to that. Or Sapphire and Steel, like, to choose a really obscure British, very good British science fiction program from the late 70s.
No wonder I've never heard of that one. Every other one you referred to so far, I've known off the top of my head, yeah, but that one I've never heard of before.
Just go look up Sapphire and Steel on Wikipedia or something. I think it only lasted six episodes, which of course by UK standards was an eternity. But you know, six episodes. They were sort of a Doctor Who-esque. They were time agents, really. Mm. But they'd investigate exceptionally abstract time related problems and phenomena. I think they ended up trapped in a two-dimensional railway station, sort of spinning through space or something. So it gives you a flavour of the type of series it was. But that might be digressing from this interview, so I'll stop plugging.
No, feel free to plug all the late 70s sci-fi series that you wish. I mean, that's always interesting.
That's why I'm in this game anyway, you realise, just to pimp 70s British science fiction. So.
Well, we all need a cause to hold up.
Absolutely, yeah. It keeps me honest, you know. I've now gone. Maybe the Triffids. I think that was 1980 or something. But anyway, I'm running out of 70s sci-fi touchstones.
Okay, so let's go to something easier then. At the end of issue 38, so I'm curious. Brainstorm, the only one who's been locked up at the end of the storyline, even though mm-hmm. Rewind and arguably World take actions similar to his intent and actually go farther than he managed to. So why is he the only one being held at this point?
Good question. Keep reading.
Okay.
my give answer. That would be entirely fair thing to ask me if you just read the last issue of More Than Meets the Eye. But you know, these things roll on. We don't have neat endings. You know, it's a serial. So you know, I mean, fair play for asking it, and that's the right question to ask. Both of you, you know, of me, but I mean, just I expect that's being asked elsewhere as well. Mm-hmm. We've got I don't know when this interview is going to be broadcast, but issue 39 it focuses purely on the DJD. Mm-hmm. So we have a break from the Lost Light, but we return with a vengeance in issue 40 on what is an entirely ship-based episode. See, I keep, you know, why even attempt not to use TV lexicon, but you know, yeah,
issue, a bottle sorry. Episode.
Yeah, true. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So yeah, no, those are very live questions, both in the minds of readers and certain characters.
Well, I mean, you can't blame me for trying. No, just with the end of the story arc and the progression it had, that's I think the one major thing still outstanding as to, well, why did it go in that direction? So. Okay, I've got some detail curiosity questions before we move into more general topics I wanted to bring up. So, in the Functionist timeline, Minimus Ambus had been part of the Primal Vanguard. Was the main Minimus also with them at some point?
The main Minimus. Do you mean the original Ultra Magnus or?
In the main timeline.
Oh, sorry. Oh, I see.
Yeah.
Okay, so in the what the one true timeline, the original timeline
Yeah.
was Minimus Ambus. You can tell that because I'm asking myself the question, I don't know the answer. Do I think Minimus Ambus was part of the Primal Vanguard? It's entirely possible. I can say this for certain. In obviously in our in the More Than Meets the Eye timeline, the Primal Vanguard ceased to be a long time before the present day. You know, I
Right.
mean, with the alternate time, the Functionist universe, of course, they're still going strong here and now. But in our universe, in my head at least, until I commit it to the page, the Vanguard more or less wound up, you know, 4 million years ago, ish. Yeah, I'm going to give you a non-committal sort of probably. Minimus was probably part of it, doing the same thing. I mean, it actually that does stand to reason. As I think about it, yeah, you've probably got a lot of similarities at that time, 4 million years ago, before the you know 4 to 5 million years ago, before the functionists consolidate their grip on the planet, really. So yeah. Okay. All right. Okay. I reckon I can do the detailed questions. That's one. That's no.
Well, this next one might be a little easier. So, Sweep, the janitor at the end,
Oh
was
yeah.
alt mode exalted. You showed us before a state of alt mode exempt, but what social benefits does exaltation offer in the world of the Functionists now?
Very good question, and the answer is bugger all, and that's sort of that's the point, really. It shows it's intended to show that. In an even more hardline functionist universe, because bearing in mind, you know, the flashback in issue 14 was to, you know, the sort of it spoke to the prevalence of functionist philosophy 4 million years ago. Well, in a timeline where that's been allowed to prof, you know, to mature into a very hardline philosophy, then the functionists have pretty much done away with any notion of being released from your function. They found a way to ostensibly, you know, recognize your specialness, but the bottom line is you still do the crappy job that you've been asked to do, you know.
So it's basically just like giving them a gold star.
Absolutely, yeah. It's yeah, exactly. It's what's the word? Yeah, I forget the word, but it's a gesture with no real meaning. And I think that's in part because I don't know if it survived the final edit, but I think there's reference in issue 35 to the abolition of the intellectual class. Certainly, yeah, I think there's reference to it sort of being turned on. So the intellect, if you were made alt mode exempt in our timeline, so to speak, 4 million years ago, you've pretty much ended up as a member of the intellectual class. You were sort of above all that and free to do what you wanted. That option disappears or has disappeared in today's functionist universe. If you're alt mode exempt, it's just a recognition that you've done something special. It doesn't amount to any life changing, any change in your lifestyle there.
So does Rewind still have Functionist timeline information in his database, or has that gone and it's just whatever is in his actual like active memory?
Right now, I think it's gone. I think that avenue has been closed off. I reserve the right to go back on that if it becomes necessary. But I think actually it's I mean they don't know. Well, I'll tell you what, they don't know whether the Functionist universe still exists or not. I mean, Perceptor speculates at the end. Whether Rewind. Thinking about it, whether Rewind still retains some sort of residual knowledge of the alternative archive, if you like, possibly, but he certainly doesn't have any link to that functionist universe going forward.
I mean, I guess there's a tangential question to this too. Is Rewind's database an external storage, or is that actually all committed to his memory and they just call it the database for conversation's sake?
I think it's I think there's a blurring there. I think it's clearly it's stored internally. The temptation is to say no, it's sort of part of him. But then that sort of raises questions about well, why does Rewind in particular have arguably this unusual capacity to store data? I imagine that some point along the way, his capacity has been augmented to the point where. You know, it's like an external hard drive plugged into your PC, but one where the sort of the link is fused, you know, probably it's probably hard to undo that now.
Mm-hmm. He has storage permanently upgraded at some point in the indistinct past, which will come up when it needs to narratively.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah. I should really be writing this down. I'll have to transcribe this myself when you put it online. Let's just spitball all my ideas now.
Well, I want to move on to some more general subjects in the last few minutes here. When we look back now at the older issues, we can see there's things that have been worded very carefully to hint at or avoid giving away certain points. Do you ever have to go back yourself and remind yourself how much you have revealed or how much you still need to explain to, like, make the next plot point move forward?
I do, partly just to be certain, because it's dangerous to rely too much on memory, particularly when, as you say, most things in the comic are exceptionally carefully worded. Partly because, you know, space is a premium, but usually because, as you say, it's striking a balance between, okay, I need to convey some information, but if I can hold something back, or if I can leave something ambiguous, or even better, if something reads as being straightforward, but upon being reread, actually you realize it did allow space for ambiguity. That's the best one. So yeah, I do need to go back and double check. It's not a foolproof process, but I can't think of any examples. It's funny because, you know, I was thinking this earlier today. I'm scripting the latest issue, and you know, as we put more issues out, and the story gets more layered, and the, if you like, the more the meets the eye mythology, if you can call it that, becomes richer. You know, just the sheer body of information and details that are out there, I increasingly need to go back and double check things and whatever. But that's cool. I mean, that's what I want, actually. I want it to be like a lovely tapestry of details and characters and stuff like that. So
we're now finally about a week and a half from when issue 39 will finally ship. What issue are you in the process of scripting now?
I am doing 43 at the moment. I got some polishing to do on 42. But really, my thoughts and my deep-seated nightmares are around 43 and making, you know, sort of moving beyond a blank page on that, right? which is a familiar and arguably healthy, if life shortening, state of affairs. But that's where I am now.
Yes, since you brought up scripting an issue, I was actually, it made me curious what the general lead time is between publication and where you're actually working in the sequence at any given point.
I can say at least there's never been a situation where Alex, being the main artist, or Alex or another artist, has been waiting for me to deliver something. So I've always been ahead in that sense. Sometimes the lead-ins are longer than others. I mean, we've had a weird few months really with scheduling, and I simply don't know all the ins and outs of why certain issues have been delayed. I know there was a lot of it down to distribution problems and shipping problems. But I know sort of from social media that people get, you know, understandably frustrated about seeing that that this issue will be released on a certain date and then nothing happens, and then they no one can really get a clear idea of when certain things are going to come out. I know IDW don't sort of put full dates out there to irritate people, but as I said the other day, as a rule of thumb, don't expect there to be less than a 4-week gap between More Than Meets the Eye issues. I mean, it sounds obvious to say that, but you know, it's going to be exceptionally unusual if one issue is delayed and then the next issue comes out a week later. Generally speaking, allow for 4 weeks between issues, and it's going to be very rare that if an issue is delayed, the next one comes out a week later or 2 weeks later. I think by the end of April, you'd have seen issue 40 come out as well, probably the last Wednesday in April. So technically by that point you'd have had 4 issues in 4 months and we should be back on track. But the other thing is, you know, base it on when the trust no one and nothing until the previews appear, pretty much. I know it's frustrating. How did we get onto that? Yeah, you were asking me about scripting, weren't you? That's right. Yeah,
right, how far, right.
Yeah, okay. So I'm scripting 43. Obviously, all the plots are down, nailed down for the next few issues. John and I had a very exciting late night conversation yesterday about our respective issue 50s and the stories that happen after that, and our season threes. Mm-hmm. So yeah, there's wow, there's some. I mean, I know what's happening with More Than Meets the Eye, but with X Rid, there's some very exciting stuff. The stuff that makes me want to just, you know, jealously spit and swear and just stomp around and glower, you know. So that's good.
Okay, so keeping on the scripting track, how much of More Than Meets the Eye did you have, like, outlined when you started writing the book, and how much of the original outline is still, like, ahead for inclusion in the story going forward?
I had, okay, so I think I certainly planned the first 12 issues before anything was printed, and then that became 16 issues, and then as John and I, you know, were thankfully saw that sales were okay and this had some legs, we were able to essentially expand the first season, sorry to keep referring it to like that, but expand the first season to about 20-22 issues. There's a lot of stuff that we've still to touch upon. There are certain things which predate issue one of More Than Meets the Eye in terms of stories I've written, which you know, there's plots there which I've yet to pick up on, but I'm going to, so that's to come. But I think I like to try and keep a good balance between introducing new mysteries and resolving old ones. I mean, Elegant Chaos was several things, and one of the things it did hopefully was resolve some long-standing mysteries, tie up some knots, you know, we'll put a bow on stuff, you know, and so we know where the Lost Lights came from. We know the Spark Eater stuff. We know things like back in Shadow Play, you know, when there was when Chrome Dome and Roller were protecting Senator Shockwave, and they were ambushed by Macabre and the others. You know, we know who gave them the tip off. Now that was Chrome Dome himself. You know, those little things we sort of tie those off and leave them be and move on to the other stuff, really. So because there does come a point where you just have too many unresolved mysteries in the background, and it's always, you know, I'm not saying I always manage to strike the balance, but ideally the balance is between telling an interesting current story with a beginning, middle, and end, if you like, and then keeping some sort of plate spinning in the background. I'm mixing metaphors, but keeping plate spinning, keeping the mysteries going in the background. And if all goes to plan, as we near the overall conclusion of the series, you know, we will shut down and resolve, you know, the if you like, the secondary mysteries, and we'll just have the big ones left to chew on.
And like as a reader, and I mean in general fictional terms, a viewer also, I mean, there does come a point where you get really like overloaded on, well, okay, they just keep piling more and more on, when are they going to solve some of this? And you know, your method of, okay, solve this, add two more, solve those, add three more, I mean, you still have enough to keep going indefinitely, I assume, but yeah, you give us payoff, you give us resolution, it's satisfying to go through and finally, oh, that's why that was that and how that happened, and yeah. So, yeah. You know, I mean, I really appreciate your sensibility in how you structure all of the storyline going through.
Well, that's reassuring, and thank you. I mean, it's all you can do is sort of put yourself in the shoes of a reader or a viewer or whatever, and think, you know, if I was on the other side of this relationship, you know, would this irritate me, or would I be expecting something now? I'll tell you what it does do. It does encourage in some quarters this sort of default assumption that everything is a mystery, and you know, this idea of it is possible to read too much into stuff, you know, and that's something I've brought about by making More Than Meets the Eye about having an element of mystery and slow burning plots. It does encourage a certain reading of the comic in the sort of critical sense, Which does encourage people to sort of speculate where really actually I didn't intend for that to be ambiguous, or I wasn't suggesting that there was anything other than what I've presented on the page, but I can't have it both ways, you know. It's, if I am going to use the medium to further mysteries in that way, then I can't complain when people see mysteries where there aren't any, you know. It's and it keeps people talking about it, and it keeps the conversation going, and something I like about and something I love about being part of the readership and the fandom is that people find stuff to you know, to debate and like to pick over old issues for clues and stuff, and yeah, okay, they generally these days they seem to be guessing what I'm planning, but you know, let's not go there.
For me, that I mean, I understand it's frustrating when you're building mysteries and wanting to reveal at a certain pace, and the fandom gets together and at the first stage figures out most of the track of it. But at the same time, the Slaughterhouse story arc, I had the best time talking with other people and working out those details, you know, in groups. And, you know, there was a really satisfying feeling when at the end of it, like, we were right, we figured it out, we got the mystery, because I love mysteries myself. And it was the most, it felt, there was this like fan interactive element of it that really resonated with me. And I mean, it, even if it didn't, even if the reveal got a little blown for you, it really, it made a reaction among your readership too.
Well, that and that's brilliant, and I don't have it. That makes me feel better. I don't have a problem with that at all. I think there's, and I hope what you've just described is the, sort of the majority experience. The downside is when even people who participate in trying to work out what's happening, if they guess and the guess is correct, and then they think, yeah, oh God, I was hoping, you know, I don't like that. I don't like the fact that I've effectively spoiled myself by guessing that correctly. You know, I can't help that really. If you're going to throw yourself into the business of trying to work out what's going on, and you correctly work out what's going on, well, good. But you know, I'm sorry, I didn't think of something to completely surprise you. That sounds far more pissy than it was meant to be. You know, I do some editing magic to make me sound less of an ass. But no, my point is only that that's if you're speculating and you're, you know, you're sort of part of that whole crowdsourcing thing because you enjoy it, and you like the fact that in some cases, you know, you've guessed it right, that's brilliant. That doesn't take away from the experience of reading it. I think I've said this before, but if I've learned anything, it's absolutely don't underestimate how smart people are, how they, you know, you guys will just. You'll find it's hard to hide the clues. You'll find them, and you'll make the right you'll make the right assumptions, if you like. So like I say, I don't want to make too much out of this. It's part and parcel of selling people mysteries. You want people to think about it and try and guess what's going on, and a sort of I don't know what a comfortable success rate is. As long as people aren't guessing everything all the time, that's probably fine. As long as I've still got the capacity to surprise some people some of the time, that's fine.
And even
That's
with the
fine.
wrap-up of Slaughterhouse, you threw the surprise in at the end with Brainstorm. So even people who guessed the details, there was still something in the issue to read and be blown away with at the last page that basically came out of nowhere.
This is true. And a true story was Alex. He'd be saying to me, you know, he said, oh, I've looked on whatever, I looked on this forum, and you know, they've guessed what's going on. They've guessed this, and they've guessed that, but they haven't guessed the Brainstorm thing yet. So, you know, thanks, Alex. At least I can cling to that.
I think I even said in my review, like, you know, speculation mostly came out right, but if you read, there is still a big thing to like hold you until the end of the issue, so don't let that color your perception if you've been reading the discussions.
But that's true, and it's, you know, it doesn't. I think the other thing is, you know, if you better be pretty confident that that the mystery, if you're gonna parcel out clues over a long period, you need to be pretty confident that that the majority of people aren't gonna guess what's going on, because then the tension drains away from the story. And I think I think Storytel, I think the Lost Light 2 arc, probably. In terms of the way the mystery was was conveyed. Probably went on an issue too long, but you know, it's yeah, you know, you live and learn, you know, and you do things differently next time.
So from reading More Than Meets the Eye, it's really clear that you've put a lot of thought into Cybertronian culture, or indeed cultures in the plural, and exploring them more deeply than we've typically seen in official fiction over the years. Are these things mainly elements you've devised since you started writing the books officially, or have you found opportunity to adapt ideas from like your Transmasters UK days?
Yeah, it's a mixture, really. I think probably the stuff that's carried over from when, you know, from when I used to write fan fiction is probably more the terminology, and not so much the sort of more deeply thought through, you know, socio-political side of things. Not so much that. I mean, that if you like the premium world building stuff, I think generally has happened now, you know, as I write sort of the official things. Mm-hmm. But things like, I mean, to pick a random example, you know, Morph Course as an alternative name for Transformation Cogs, mm-hmm. that's been kicking around in my head for a while. Conjunct Endura is an entirely, you know, new concept, the name and the idea. That's definitely an IDW era idea. Yeah, I think I probably have recycled it. So, but bottom line, I've probably recycled a few character names and you know, slang or terminology, but the societal stuff has grown organically as part of writing More Than Meets the Eye.
Okay, that's cool. I've read Eugenesis, and yeah, I mean, there's a few character names that I saw cross over between those, and probably some technical terminology as well that I'm probably blanking on at the moment, but you know, your style presents itself really solidly in both, so it's interesting to find out like what the crossover is conceptually from your older fan writing days and now doing the official writing for the comics.
Yeah, I mean, I don't often go back to I don't often go back to any of my stuff, you know, whether official or non-official, but certainly I think as I was cutting my teeth on Transformer stories unofficially, I placed much less of a premium on actual character driven stuff. It was more concept driven or event driven, you know, or set piece driven, if that makes sense. And Eugenesis, I'm very proud of Eugenesis, but if I was to write it again, it would be powered by people, by characters more than it is. I mean, it's not, don't get me wrong, it's not entirely sort of devoid of that. I mean, mm-hmm. Prowl and Nightbeat and Prime himself have all got sort of, you know, the story is driven in part by the things they do and think. But yeah, it's the shift in emphasis in the last 5 years. Well, more than that, really, because I didn't do any Transformers stuff for you know, for any of the 21st century until Wreckers came along. But you know, my fan fiction days and my current writing are different in the respect of, I guess, the character stuff, but also the anthropomorphology, really. The fact that I was quite a purist as a fan. You know, I there wouldn't be, I can't think of any examples now, but you know, I'd always be keen to emphasize the robotic nature, the mechanical nature of them, and to really that there'd be very little, if any, sort of pop cultural references, overtly or otherwise, in my unofficial writings. I've relaxed a lot about that now, and a part of the steer from Hasbro, if you like, when phase two of the IDW era happened, you know, with Death of Optimus Prime and stuff, mm-hmm. it was sort of, you know, you'd humanize these characters, make us care about them as people. And I know, mm-hmm. even the use of the term people is controversial in the context of Transformers, but you know, make them people we care about, and that was good, because that just seemed to coincide with the approach I wanted to take anyway, which was to make you worry about them and like them or hate them. I'm not saying that the plot, if you like, is secondary, not at all. But you know, the focus should be on the people, and not so much on what happens to them, if that makes sense.
And ultimately, too.
So I think that's.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, go.
Ultimately,
please stop me talking.
Ultimately, I think the characters are the ones that need to drive the plot anyway. So if one needs to be focused over the other, it should be the characters, in my opinion.
You're right, and I will be very careful not to blow my own trumpet, but I was sat, put it this way, I was satisfied that ultimately Elegant Chaos, the resolution to that storyline was pretty much all about, you know, these people taking these decisions or acting in this way because that's what they're like. Mm-hmm. You know, it wasn't external events happening to them. That they weren't victims of stuff. Stuff was happening because they were who they were. Mm-hmm. And that's what I, to me, that makes for a satisfying story.
Absolutely. I agree with you 100%.
Mm-hmm. Cool.
Here's another conjectural piece for you to add to your notebook, maybe. I'm curious about the functional relation between Spark and Brain Module. So, like, obviously the Spark is the animating life force, but in your interpretation of the biology, I guess, how far does it go? Mm. Like, in terms of making an individual who they are, where does the Spark end and the Brain begin?
I think that the Brain is hardware, clearly. It's exceptionally complex hardware, but think of it as a translation system or as a decoder. It takes the patterns, the personality algorithms or whatever inherent in the Spark and translates that into an active personality, if you know what I mean. Mm-hmm. And if I get an opportunity to organically convey that in the stories, I will I will take it because I think that's I know another area of confusion is to do with Rossum's Trinity, really. I mean, we've established, I think, way back in issue 3 that let's put it this way, certainly if you destroy the Spark, that's the end of the story. Okay, that's the end of that person. They are dead. If you destroy the Brain Module, or you detach, we've established already before War Meets the Eye that you can strip away everything else apart from the Spark, and still that is a living being. So clearly, you know, the Brain Module isn't integral to the survival of that person. Mm-hmm. But nonetheless, if you're fully connected, if your Brain, Spark, and Transformation Cog are all in harmony, and violently and unexpectedly, one of those three is certainly the Spark, we know. But if the Brain Module is destroyed, or even potentially the T-Cog is destroyed, that could kill you as a person. That could, think of it almost as a feedback. It could destroy the Spark. So what am I saying? I'm saying that you destroy a Spark, there's no coming back from that. You could destroy a Brain Module, and as an immediate byproduct, destroy the Spark, and so you're dead. I think the T-Cog is the lesser of those three corners. Mm. You know, we know that you can rip it out, you can take it out yourself. The Triple M, they'll remove it, and so it's the lesser of Rossum's Trinity, and the Spark is the greatest. And I probably need to say everything I've just said on paper before, but I think there's a logical consistency to what I've just said.
Mm-hmm. I think so too. Now, like, pursuant to that, like, if could someone take a Brain Module from one chassis essentially and put it in another, and it would not affect overtly who the individual is?
Yes, I think with I say yes guardedly. It may be that over time, a bit like Rewind in his archive, there is some sort of symbiotic relationship or connection between a Brain Module and a particular Spark, mm-hmm. which makes recycling the brain difficult. I'm putting that out there. We'll see. Again, we'll see if I can sort of cement that through the stories themselves. But right now, that's my take on it.
It may sound weird, but that's been one of the biggest questions I've had since this phase of IDW stories have started, where there's been such an emphasis on the Rossum's Trinity, just how the elements relate to each other, and especially the Brain and the Spark, because
I think it's coming back to me now. I think with the controversial quote unquote death of a Red Alert, the decapitation of Red Alert. I think that there's some detail there about how it is possible to, a bit like a chicken, really. You can reattach the brain to the spark and save the person. And I think you can also consciously decouple the brain from the spark, again, which you must have to do if we've already established that you can have sparks, freestanding sparks, contained. I think with the death of Trailcutter, that the brain and the spark were still connected. It was out with or outside of Trailcutter's really control that he was going to suddenly suffer a severe blunt trauma to the brain module, which had the effect of short-circuiting and wiping out his spark. So that's a brain module related death in the context of Rossum's Trinity.
One more sub question related to this, and then we'll move on, I promise.
I'm sweating, I'm sweating. I'm just pacing the room now. I've just watched the first of the UK prime ministerial debates, or interviews on, and I know how Cameron and Miliband feel now. You're for our British listeners, you're the Jeremy Paxman of this conversation. So okay.
Memories like Rewind has his database, which you seem to imply is a hardware element, but the spark to be what it is must also store some memories. So do you feel there's like is a redundancy in hardware memory, or is there like a delineation between them? Something are stored in hardware, some things are retained by the spark itself.
Perhaps that's what sets archivists like Rewind apart from your general population, is that the price of acquiring that amount of data is that a proportion of it is going to be outside of the spark and therefore lost to him, if or detachable, really. Maybe there's some sort of limit to how many memories. I actually, as I speak, I'm thinking about the concept of information creep and the susceptibility of, if you like, memory data to corruption over time. So maybe that's linked to the spark's ability to faithfully preserve memory, and actually thinking about it, yeah, it's it that there'd be some link there to the ability to preserve data and memory on external devices too. Yeah, okay. I'm gonna say that there is a maybe there isn't a limit to how many memories you could, like us. There's a clear analogy to humans here. I know we arguably retain every single thing that happens to us, but accessing that memory is something else. And maybe that's the case with a spark. Maybe it absorbs every experience that happens to the person, but actually accessing those memories is difficult. And maybe mnemosurgeons or experts like Chrome Dome are, unusually adept at finding and retrieving those memories in others. Maybe that's where this.
I suppose that too could be why someone who's extremely aged, like Cup, would not always be able to remember an event clearly from his past because he's absorbed so much, and in the almost organic process of retrieving that information from inside him has gotten so complex that he seems, verging on senile sometimes.
Absolutely, and I think you can't, and I've probably been accused of drawing too many parallels between humans and Transformers, but I think this is one area where you can fruitfully and legitimately say there's an overlap there in how humans, store memories and can't retrieve them, and also how, dementia sufferers, forget things. I think that's true of Transformers, and it there's a wider sort of outside universe imperative to establish that too, because with the Transformers timeline being as it is, I know the reason I invented information creep was because it was really bugging me that, okay, they've been fighting for 4 million years. The Knights of Cybertron and the earliest the beginning of their civilization was 12 million years ago. Well, okay, that's only three times as long as your war's been going on, and you've got people, it appears, who have been living for that period of time. So why don't you just ask some, why don't you just ask an old guy, to tell you what happened? So the attempted solution was to introduce this idea of unreliable memory, essentially, and a blurring of facts and fiction and stuff. So it was a narrative get out clause, but it's quite a useful one, I think.
Okay, so two more questions, and then we can wrap up because I've kept you for quite a while.
It's okay. He says, choking back the tears.
So, at the end of Elegant Chaos, or near to it, Megatron was created in, I believe, 12th cycle. What happened to restart the calendar? Because if that's only 12 cycles or years, analogously, what was the point where they rolled the calendar over to a new system?
If there is a point if there's a point where they do that, which renders every apparent mistake not a mistake, then it's that point. because it's very complicated. I mean, the I roundabout, I think it's issue 12. I deliberately introduced this idea of there being like a switching calendar as an attempt to reconcile some mistakes that have been made, you know, in terms of, okay, this happened here, but how come, you know, because it goes back to world building, entirely understandably, because I'd have done this too. You want to make sense of, you want to say, okay, this is the means by which this civilization parcels out time. Okay, this is the way they measure time. There's got to be some sort of consistency in that. So how, let's work with the information we've been given. How can we extrapolate the speed of time, if you like, or the measurement of time? And I think that the sad reality is, you know, in universe, it hasn't been used consistently as a method of marking time. So my sort of in a sadly hand wavy way, sort of saying, okay, yeah, but they switched calendars at some point. I was hoping that was enough to sort of, you know, whitewash over the cracks really and say, anything which you can't, which doesn't add up is because the people are using different calendars. From your question, it appears that hasn't been sufficient. I don't know. I mean, it's, I think I have made an old school mistake in some of the dating in Elegant Chaos, which I need to go back and check and if necessary fix for the trade. I think I may have made just a simple error in terms of Megatron's birth date, which is embarrassing, but sorry. I didn't, you know, it goes back to your earlier question. Do I go back and check things? I do. So I don't know how that happened, but if things aren't quite adding up and the two calendar explanation doesn't work, I think it's going to come down to a mistake. And I don't know. Sorry.
I think it's really just a matter of it's so close to the start of the current calendar system that it starts people to wonder, okay, so what happened like 12 years or however you, whatever analog you have for cycles, you know, what happened that little bit of time beforehand that made the transition?
Okay, I'm going to give you a live piece of world building then, because I think what happened was it comes down to the tug of war between the Senate and the Functionists. And I think that there are particular revered Functionist figures, historical figures, around whom they would argue, sometimes successfully, that the calendar should pivot, if you like. So a bit like BC and AD. I think they've said, okay, it's a bit of a retroactive exercise because we're going to say that this particular person or this event that happened X number of years ago is contemporaneously deigned to be important. So we're saying, okay, like now, okay, so in the year 2015 we're going to discover something or assert that in the 14th century this person was born or did this, and that's now assuming greater importance than it was given at the time. So we are going to decide that from that point, consequent on something we've just decided, from that point we're going to change the calendar system. So I think that's what's happened in the context of some sort of competing ideologies. Some one side has successfully argued that all of a sudden that's important, so we're going to change it there.
So at the time they were actually there witnessing Megatron in his mid-construction state, they may not have been calling it cycle 12 at that point. It could have been X number on whatever the previous system was before somebody changed it at a later point.
Yeah, so we could say in 2015 it could be that something happens tomorrow where we decide that, you know, 1843 is actually more important than we gave it credit for, So that's now going to become zero. Mm-hmm. It's not something like that. Yeah.
Okay, that makes sense. That makes a lot of sense, actually.
Okay, good. I'm going to hold you to that. Okay, you said that makes sense. That's been cemented now.
Excellent. I am pleased to have been here at a moment of live world building for the IDW universe.
And for everybody that hasn't got access to the CCTV cameras in this room, I was literally pacing the room when we had that conversation. Okay.
Okay. So for the last question, I'd like to wrap up on what I think is a big one. How has the experience mm-hmm. been for you in taking Megatron and developing him in this new direction?
Oh, what was the first part of that question? Sorry,
how has the experience been for you?
How's the experience been for me? Oh, well, really satisfying. Actually, I'll be honest with you. When it was decided that Megatron should become an Autobot, my instantaneous reaction was, oh my god, that's mad, but really exciting. You know, that's really exciting. I just had this straight away. I had this vision of sort of. Think of it as almost like a movie poster, sort of for season two. There's the familiar cast, but Megatron's at the front with an Autobot badge. That was so wrong. It was somehow right. So that was my immediate reaction. And then again, to retread an earlier anecdote, sort of that night, I was thinking, yeah, but oh my god, how can that possibly happen without it just breaking the universe in two? You know, sort of how can we pull that off? And so between that point and the early issues of season two being published, it was still sort of, wow, I don't know whether this is going to hang. And there will be people out there screaming at their computers now saying, you know what? It doesn't hang together. It doesn't make sense. And I don't buy into it. And you've really balled that up. But I'm okay in myself. I think that it's I'm happy with where we are. And the more we've got into season two, the more happy I've become. And, you know, it's going to surprise nobody when I say that pretty much every single issue, every story, to a greater or lesser extent, has been about Megatron. And I think that's right. And I think if you're going to take, you know, the arguably the second most iconic character in the Transformers mythos, and you're going to do something so fundamentally unusual with him, then you damn well better spend enough time exploring what that means and why that's happened, and if that amounts to Megatron being the narrative fuel for 26 issues, then yeah, that's how it should be.
And like I really enjoyed this new take on Megatron, because like a Megatron in this context, in you know a semi G1 based continuity like this is. Like the first time a Megatron in that context has been genuinely newly interesting in the longest time, because when Megatron was reintroduced in what was then Robots in Disguise and mm-hmm. was just trying to burn Iacon back to the ground, I felt terrible about it because it felt like things were going back to like an old mm-hmm. status quo or trying to. But then as the time went on and the development happened and we got to this Autobot Megatron, it's like everything through the whole process has been worth it to get to this, which is the most interesting characterization this kind of Megatron has ever had, possibly.
Oh, that I'm really pleased that you feel that, because I mean that I'm getting a real buzz out of exploring his character. I mean, it's a little like I said before, really. You know, we didn't as John was writing that Megatron, the Megatron that, you know, the sort of return from the wilderness. You know, we didn't know that an Autobot Megatron was around the corner. Thankfully, because I've always been genuinely interested in both him and in the origins of the Decepticons. When mm-hmm. I wrote Chaos Theory, I wanted to. When Chaos Theory was written, of course, you know, long before any notion of Megatron switching sides. But mm-hmm. it was just interesting to me in exploring the relationship between Megatron and Prime and the origins of the Decepticons. And just generally as well, I'd much more readily subscribe to this idea that that villainous people, you know, don't consider themselves to be villainous, and that's not an original observation, but mm-hmm. you know that works for me. I mean, in terms of motivation and explaining why you do what you do, the worst possible answer is, well, I do it because I'm not a nice person. The more interesting answer is, I do it because it's right, as far as I'm concerned, and it's right because, and season two is really about explaining what that means, really. So the effect of chaos theory, it was useful to have that out there. I was able to build upon that in ways that I didn't realize I would need to when I originally wrote it.
And just like beyond the changes to Megatron himself, it's been really interesting too, the way you've wrote the characters around him and how their perceptions are shifting, sometimes even without them realizing, where all of a sudden they have this epiphany that, you know, I almost kind of like this guy now, and it's terrible.
Yeah, I think maybe we've touched upon that most explicitly in the Slaughterhouse issues. Mm-hmm. And it's maybe it's just me, but I think it would be difficult to sustain that level of sort of active hatred towards somebody. If it's different if, God, this is getting into some strange territory here conversationally, but I mean, if somebody did something awful to you or your family, it would be easy. But I mean, if you're operating on sort of almost an abstract level of evil, where you've just, you know, you're the orchestrator of terrible things. And then, and I think that actually that's interesting to me in itself, going from, if you're Skids, for example, and, you know, you've spent most of your life in terms of the war fighting against the other side, who are, you know, governed and controlled and given orders by a distant figure. Even during wartime, you know, you'll hate Megatron, but, you know, you rarely see him, if ever. You may never have come across him. He's almost just, you know, he's just a distant architect. And then suddenly you're living alongside him, cheek by jowl. And, you know, he's not going to go around and remind you of his evil ways, you know, in everything he does and says. Quite the opposite, actually. He's relatively contrite. He's strip away the history, and it wouldn't actually be that bad, you know, having Megatron, you know, living with Megatron. It would be if you can overlook the minor matter of mass, you know, genocide.
Right.
You'd probably get along okay, really. They'd be worse flatmates, you know. Mm-hmm. So I think the sort of the existential dilemma which Skids and others are grappling with now is, you know, you sort of almost want him to be more of an objectionable character on a daily basis, so you could refresh your hatred towards him, you know, while he's being level-headed and reasonable and relatively contrite and the rest of it. It's easier. It takes less effort just to sort of roll with it, I think. Is and that's yeah. I mean that's. I don't know. You could have written 50 issues about how various characters were getting their heads around Megatron being on board, but you know, there's other things to do, like, you know, tell stories about the here and now and about having adventures and furthering the overall plot. So there's only so much room for stuff.
Mm-hmm. Well, and you mentioned in Slaughterhouse there was like the overt conversation about this, but I interpreted, I don't know if this was your intention. In I think issue 37, we see Ultra Magnus' vision, where it's listing everything Megatron's done, and then Ultra Magnus says, "I'm just getting used to you being on board still." Like, to me, that seemed like a subtle reference to Ultra Magnus even having these same thoughts, because he is just standing there and like cordially talking to Megatron, and like he's relating to him as a person, and he's seeing the information still flash before his eyes, and he's having difficulty reconciling that. I don't know if that's just me reading into it farther, or if you actually did plant that in there. If so, I'm very impressed.
Well, obviously, given you've said that, it's clearly what you think. But yes. Honestly, it was two things. It was, and this is when this works, it feels good. But I mean, on one level, I needed to have a panel through Magnus's eyes in order to contrast that with the readout you had near the end of the issue,
right,
where, you know, that's your indication that something bad has happened and Megatron has been erased. So that was the top level, if you like, the reason. But absolutely, the other purpose of that panel was to remind you that, as we've been talking about, really, it's someone like Ultra Magnus. If you forget what Megatron's done, Magnus will find Megatron far more easy to get along with than he would with Rodimus, and that's something we've nodded towards that in the past. I think in issue 30 was it, when, you know, when they've taken the coffin on board. There's certainly been more than one occasion where Magnus has sort of, whether he realizes it or not, sort of sided with Megatron over Rodimus in terms of his approach to tackling a crisis. And yeah, I just think it fascinates me. You know, the as I say, it takes a lot more effort to have to continually remind yourself, you know, I should hate this person, and I should be expressing my hate this way or that, rather than like, well, you know, we're on board a ship together. He's not right now. This person isn't doing anything, you know, that's working against me or that I object to. So, you know, what are you going to do, really? So you have got to sort of go with it, really. Yeah. So, yes.
And then you go to comparing Rodimus Star stories.
Exactly. Yeah. I think, but that's sort of that's the point where they bond, really.
Mm-hmm.
I think deep down Magnus would, well, no, not even deep down. I think probably Rodimus knows that Magnus thinks the Megatron is probably the better commander, really. And that's going to, mm-hmm. and actually that accounts for, I mean, it was a conscious decision of mine to almost backpedal on some of Rodimus's character development, in the sense that I think had Megatron not come along or not been forced upon Rodimus, then he would have made good a lot of his promises to himself and to others at the end of Remain in Light. I think he would have strived to be a better commander, a more mature commander, more aware of his responsibilities. But if you're just starting to sort of truly confront your personal foibles and thinking, you know what, I'm committed to doing better, and then almost your agency is removed from you because, you know, Optimus Prime in this case says, I'm going to stick this guy on your ship, whether you like it or not. And, mm-hmm. you know, and then there's some ambiguity around whether he's in charge or not, but, you know, just roll with it. You're going to be like, well, you know what? Just screw all of you, really. I'm just going to, you know, whether I'm conscious I'm doing it or not, I'm going to revert, aren't I? It's like, it's almost like a Rodimus tantrum, really. You know, what he's thinking, well, what's the payoff for me? If I, you know, I suppose he could try and rise to the occasion and prove that he's you know, even more mature than Megatron. But Rodimus being Rodimus, the easy option is just reverting to type, really. So we mm-hmm. have had a bit of a hopefully explicable regression in his in his way, in the way that he operates. And actually that is useful to the plot as well, because you need a bit of a it's good to have a Rodimus, an old school Rodimus, around to keep things a bit chaotic,
to counterbalance Megatron's professional seriousness.
Absolutely. If you had Megatron, Magnus, and Rodimus all being super professional, they'd have probably found the knights by now.
You know? And then you'd be out of story to tell.
Exactly. So Rodimus is doing us all a favor.
I certainly think so. Well, James, this has been a tremendous conversation, a great interview. I so appreciate the time you've given me and the technical difficulties you've endured through this process.
No, that's all right. It's only a combination of me losing my voice and needing to go to the toilet that's really bringing this to a close. So,
and I actually have dinner ahead of me yet, too.
Oh, right. Okay. Well, look, I think the powers that be are trying to tell us this is a good place to stop. So,
yes, sir.
Thank you for putting me through my paces. I will definitely have to listen back to this and make notes of what I've suddenly decided is fact.
Got to keep it consistent.
Got to, exactly, yes. So anyway, thank you for that. And speak to you again soon.
I certainly hope so. I look forward to continuing to read more of the Meets the Eye for some time to come. Thank you, James.
Good. Cheery.
Good night.
Need to catch up? Visit tfradio.net/Amazon and start shopping for collected volumes of all the Transformers titles. For comic book news, reviews, and more, visit tformers.com. Fanboy vs. Transformers is a Radio Free Cybertron production.